This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about lifelong learning and making decisions now about your future care. And to lead us in that discussion is Mike Townsend. Mike? Fellow seminar presenter, life experience extraordinaire, and captivating. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you?
Everything's good. And John Elliott, federal benefits strategist, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, and another good guy as well. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, Bob.
And I'm Bob Lines. I'm also a seminar presenter and a tax finance type. So, Mike, I got your kind of outline here. Lifelong learning. How do you continue your education, and why do you want to continue your education? I was lucky to get out of school.
Well, that was first time around. We'll see for the next round. Well, Bob, first of all, let me emphasize the why, because the how is fairly easy. But the why is this. So there are probably three reasons. The first, because of the fact that as we grow older, our memories and our cognitive functioning slows up very naturally, whether we have illness to contribute to it or not. And often that is the case. But even without that, it will slow up. And so the mind, the brain, is very much like any other muscle. If we don't use it, it will atrophy. It will cease to function in the ways that it used to. The way to keep it going longer, everybody says, and every study says the same thing, that we ought to be doing things that that exercise that muscle, the brain. Certainly reading regularly, doing crossword puzzles, Sudoku, although good luck with that one, any kind of board games, those kinds of things are all excellent ways of exercising our minds. But one disciplined way of doing that exercise is in the context of taking courses, and actually learning something that we didn't know before. And to do that like we did when we were younger. And only now we can do it for or not for credit and like that. But let me not get into that just yet, because that's just one reason. Keeping the mind and the brain alive and functioning and younger. And there are studies just recently that say that even if we do eventually get Alzheimer's, for example, as one form of dementia, that we will be able to, if we're doing these mental exercises, we can stave it off, keep it further out in time before it actually has the kind of effect. So when they first see symptoms and so forth, that when a person does any kind of learning, that the progression is slowed significantly. And so good data there. So that's reason number one. The second reason is an important one to people in all ages, but certainly once we pass our 50s and 60s, and that is socialization. One outlet for that. You know, much of the socialization that we do throughout our lives as adults has been through our work. That's where we had friends, we had people around the water cooler, and folks we had lunch with, and that sort of thing. That's gone after we retire. Maybe it tapers off, and we still meet for lunches and so forth, but it does taper off and eventually is non-existent. We still, however, have a need for socialization, and finding outlets for that is very important. And so One way to do that is college courses or high school courses. It could be any kind of learning. We'll meet other people who are similarly situated and trying to learn too. Just as a point there, a pushback I got in a workshop recently, somebody said, well, now, wait a minute. If I went back to school, I'm going to be sitting in a room with a bunch of kids, right? So that's going to make me uncomfortable. I don't see how I can make friends, etc. My experience has been that if you choose the course and the timing of the course well, that you pretty much ensure that you'll be in with adults. For example, I've taken two courses at Montgomery College totally for something that I just was interested in. By the way, it was free because I'm over 60, maybe it ever so barely. And that and at Montgomery College and others, it is a free ride. Pay the fees, but not the tuition. It's waived. Now, I've taken a couple of those. And in both cases, there were adults. Maybe I was one of the older ones, but they were all adults in their 40s plus that were in the classes because I selected the nighttime and weekend options. And therefore, I wasn't in class with teenies or tweenies. And so socialization is a very important thing. Now, the third reason to continue our learning is one that a lot of people may not think of, but it's one that I place a lot of value on, which is, as we have probably always been, we are ever more so. Once we become retired, we're also moving into the role of major domo of our families. We are grandparents now. There's a different relationship that we have to the balance of our family. One of the opportunities that presents as the sage of the family is the opportunity to model, meaning to show the way for generations after us. And what better way is there to encourage younger members of our clan to stay in school, value education, value. Very few ways are better than doing this, what I'm suggesting, which is model it, show them. Don't just tell them, go out and do it yourself. And it gives you a very powerful, I've already been able to use it in my family, it gives you a powerful argument to be able to say, this is not just what I say, it's also what I do. That's how strongly I believe in this, and oh, by the way, it never ends. And so learning is valuable in that way. I hope that answers it, Tim.
Now,
go ahead.
Go, John.
Is it, when you take courses and you don't care about credit, are there courses available in college, I'm talking about, where you don't have to get a grade?
Yes.
Because, who wants that pressure to,
sure,
get that A or whatever it is?
Mm-hmm. The two courses that I took, I audited. And,
oh, that's right.
That
I'd forgotten all about auditing.
Yep. Yeah. And therefore, I did not receive a grade at the end, though it certainly would have been an A. But,
but of course.
But no, I didn't need it because I wasn't adding that to anything.
Yeah. So you can just do it for pleasure.
Absolutely.
The pleasure of learning something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this should be in one's profession or not in one's profession, or what difference does it make?
Doesn't matter. Anything that's of interest. And if we've been doing that profession, which a lot of us will have been 30 plus years, we may just want to look at something a little different and something maybe that had caught our imagination earlier in life or at some other point. And we kind of always parked that and thought, someday I'm going to check into that. I'm curious about it. And the topic that I pursued was mediation. I had always heard of mediation. Of course, as an HR executive, I had hired mediators over the years in various organizations. I had no idea how they were trained or how they got to be. It certainly seemed like something that I would probably enjoy doing, but again, wasn't on my career path. And so once freed of that career path by having retired. I saw it a couple of courses in mediation in the brochure of Montgomery College. And thought, well, let's see, it doesn't cost much, and I can learn about something that I never knew about. And by the way, even though I didn't get a grade in that, I was able to take the certificate that they gave me at the end and register myself in Maryland, and I'm now a certified mediator in Maryland. I'm not pursuing it particularly, haven't done much with it. That's fairly recent, but it's there. It's an option, and something maybe I'll do. I certainly learned a lot about it.
It's interesting. I think of mediators as more on the attorney side of life. So yeah. There's mediators for social issues, or is it, it's not legal issues, I wouldn't
say. No. Yeah. It's for social issues. The area that I targeted and actually went to a third learning, but that did cost me, was I went down to Texas and went to a one-week course in elder care mediations. Which, because of my interest in my own tribe, the older among us, that I wanted to see how to apply the skills of mediation to be helpful to older folks, and there's a huge need for that. And if I go into that area, that's what I'll probably specialize in. Will be helping folks, essentially, helping older folks talk to their families. And vice versa, and hear each other, and come to conclusions and make plans together, rather than what often becomes a tragic argument.
So this could be that's very interesting to me, because I deal with folks at all stages of life, but as I age, the clients age, and then some of the clients get a little flaky, like me. and then there's a battle with the family. Do we sell the house? Do we put mom and dad into a nursing home? We don't want to spend too much money on the house because we want more money when they're gone. That could get ugly.
It does. One of the... and in fact, I had a practice case while I was in Texas. That was just that situation. And they actually, real people were brought in with a real issue. And it really did boil down to the distinctions between mom and dad and their wishes versus the wishes of their children and their children's spouses, who should not be ignored in that negotiation. Anyhow, it is clearly an area that where there's lots of work that can be done, and it's good work. It really does help people, because just as you say, it can lead to rifts in families for generations that last generations, if a conclusion that's acceptable to all parties is not drawn. And that starts with, which is what mediation is, listening to each other and honoring the desires of each other and finding a middle ground often. That's really what mediation is.
Two of the worst business experiences of my life were somewhat mediation. I wasn't the mediator. I was the bean counter. And it was parents, children, spouses. Mm-hmm. The first one, I was... didn't know it was going to get that ugly, and I was very far from the exit door. and the second one I knew was not going to be pleasant, so I got real close to the door, and when they just started tearing into each other, I said, nice seeing y'all.
Sure.
I hope all of you survive. Goodbye. But a mediator could have, I couldn't have been the mediator, because that would have been seen to take sides, but that's very interesting that profession exists. Because I have clients that are legal mediators, and actually they like it better than litigation. Mm-hmm. And they sit down and say, okay, you want this, you want this. Let's see where we can meet. And if we can't meet, then we have to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I see sometimes in contracts that they waive the rights to go to court, and they'll just go to mediation.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So a growing...
And often at the suggestion of the court, by the way.
Yeah. Well, it unclogs the court, and... Mm-hmm. seems very interesting that you say that, on the social side.
What about just reading? I mean, you talk about going to a formal class, but what if you just read on your own? Does that keep your mind up?
Yes. Yeah, real positives there, and is highly recommended by the psych folks the social psychologists who write about these things. You bet.
Yeah, is there any value, greater value in reading a tougher book, like on astrophysics or quantum mechanics versus a novel, or just the act of reading is all about the same?
Actually, that's a great question, because texts on physics, for example, would be so specialized that they would only use a portion of the brain. You know what's recommended by, again, by social psychologists, and I'm familiar with the folks in the neurology group at Johns Hopkins, where I'm a graduate. The Hopkins, I threw that right in there.
It's very slick.
They recommend primary reading to be novels that have a whodunit involved. And the reason is because of the parts of the brain that will therefore stimulate, which are analysis, the ability to take some bits of data and put them somewhere where you can retrieve them, and then how to pull it all together at the end to see if you can outguess the plot and so forth, that they say that is actually the best exercise for both of us, most of us.
Well, that's good to know, because I did read, just because I got interested in it, a book by a cosmologist, Center of the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
What it was tough, it was a tough slog.
Yes.
But I don't read those books very often. I prefer either novels or lighter nonfiction than that.
Sure.
So that's reassuring. Okay, so my brain may atrophy, but since I read, it may not atrophy at a great pace. Is that's what you're saying?
Yes.
Good.
Yep. Mike, is in your profession, or your many professions, you're both a career and a life coach.
Yes.
What's the difference between a career and a life coach? I think I know, but...
Yeah. A career coach is really a subset of the other, of the life coaching. But career coaching usually focuses primarily on the how. How to get from one professional slot to another, either through promotions or transfers or leaving entirely to do something. Those are generally the questions that are presented to me when someone asks for career coaching. However, I ask all of my clients to think in terms of the bigger questions, because the career is a subset of our life, that to learn who we are, to be familiar with our likes and dislikes, which may or may not be on the surface. So to become more aware of those, and there's testing you can do to actually identify these things, and then measure whether the career field, in this case, or in other areas of life, if your relationships or choices of where to live and things like that, but are they consistent with who you are and what you enjoy and what really rounds out your life? Are you paying attention to that? That's the bigger question. So even when people present with I'm just curious how I got laid off and I need to get another job, so help me write my resume, please. That to me is asking, it would be like going to a doctor and saying, listen, I know you haven't examined me yet, but I'd like a prescription for the following, please. You're probably not going to get it. And the reason is the doctor has to take the bigger picture into account and understand what it is that's going on and what, therefore, will be the most helpful prescription for you. And likewise, in my view, in both life coaching and career coaching, it's essential to work on understanding of self and fan that into choices, rather than the other way around, which is how most people do it.
Okay. Before we go too much further without a phone number, people, if you'd like to call, we're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's 10:25 a.m. Monday, September 13th, 2010. We're on for about another 35 minutes. So don't call us after that because you won't get us. However, you can email us, and we'll talk about the email later at 24/7. And take the advantage of Mike transitioning to wherever you might. John, federal benefits expert, and I'm finance tax type. But let me ask you this. We deal a lot with pre-retirement, but we do a significant amount of mid-career and beginning career seminars as well. Mm-hmm. So as far as life or career coach, do you ever reach down to the mid-career type or maybe even the beginning career? And I've gone to school and I've learned X, but I don't know that I want to do X. Mm-hmm. What can I do as a tangent, or somebody mid-career that's very good at what they do but maybe tiring of it and they've always wanted to do something? How do you coach them?
Well, let me take the early career or the recent grad first, because oftentimes, I'll tell you, there are just a couple of ways that people usually pursue at least their first career excursion. And the primary way is what psychologists call modeling. And modeling simply means replicating what you've seen someone else do. So, for example, a lot of folks who, and I did this too. Wait a minute, I could use myself. I don't talk about others. I was raised by my grandfather here in Washington. He was a wonderful old country doctor kind of guy. Just believed a lot in natural things and so forth, and was just a wonderful, brilliant guy. When I graduated from high school, went to college, didn't know what to declare as a major, but in my first year at Georgetown, I declared myself a pre-med major. There was no logical reason, really, to do that other than I was modeling someone who I so admired. And it was less than a semester it took for me and for my professors to come to the starstruck conclusion that medicine was not for me. For example, in lab, I wouldn't touch dead things. I don't do that. I don't touch them without three or four sets of latex gloves on and at least a yardstick distance away from it, and then I might touch it just be it ever so, but I don't know what it died from, so I don't want it like that. When I explained this to the professor, he said, come see me after the break, and then informed me that medicine was not for me. And so I ended up getting a degree in philosophy, but and was much happier doing it. But the point is, I started out for what I thought were good reasons, because I didn't know anything else. What I recommend to all folks now is to first of all, acknowledge that undergraduate is an opportunity. Our undergraduate years are opportunities to learn how to learn. Therefore, whatever we major in ought to be something that is purely intellectually interesting to us, that will keep us awake and alive and engaged in the process. Undergraduate rarely has much effect on the eventual outcome. It does for some people, but not in most professions. In most professions, if there's an educational credential, it's usually a graduate certification or a degree of some sort. And then they care about what school you went to and what the program was and what was your major and that kind of thing. But undergraduate, I was an HR guy for 30 years. I can tell you, we never really cared about what the undergraduate work was all about, nor really much the grades. Although I certainly recommend if somebody came in with a straight D average, they were probably had an uphill battle with us, but C's, B's, A's is all the same, because there's lots of reasons why those things occur. Doesn't really tell you about intellect. So I certainly recommend that anybody who has who is in school, that they should take, before they graduate, best early in their educational undergraduate education, they ought to, no matter what they're majoring in, they ought to go to their career center and ask the career center folks to administer career assessment testing. These are wonderful now. They've really improved over the last 10, 15 years. The Holland exam is probably one of the best, but most schools will give a battery of tests, not just one. But in addition, perhaps to Holland, they'll also give, one of the tests that tests for likes and dislikes and other kinds of choices that we enjoy. In the end, when the results are tabulated, a trained interpreter will be able to read the results and tell the person who took the test, here's what you're telling the test, and you're telling yourself. If you did this genuinely and you answered everyone as honestly as possible, you're telling it that here are four or five families of jobs who people like you, who score like you do, will be happy with this kind of work. And I got to tell you that at least now I try these out all the time and I haven't found one better than Holland yet. However, I will say that they are, even now when I'm retired, I took them just a few weeks ago, just to test out a new one, and it was spot on. With amazing, I don't remember it asking me anything about what it was telling me, but it did. I'm not a testing expert, so I don't know why it works. I just know that it does. So I recommend to people in school, take those tests. Now, you know what? What's interesting is that I think it's interesting to say that that is advice not only that I give to people in school, people who have graduated, people who are mid-career, and when a person retires, I recommend to them they take those tests again. For one thing, we change. Not a lot, but we do change over time. With new information and experiences, we mold a little bit who we are and evolve. Having said that, when we choose whether in retirement to be purely enjoying our leisure or to be a combination of leisure and part-time job, some people will go into a full-time, another full-time. They're healthy enough and young enough. They decide, well, I'll go into another job for 5, 10, 15 years full-time, which, by the way, then they haven't really retired. Don't call yourself retired because you're not, but you are in your second career. But here's my point. Even at that point of retirement, it's very important to have tested ourselves, understand the feedback from that, and set a direction. In other words, what kind of work will I do in my second, what many are calling the encore job? What will that be? Most people who do not take those, you know what they end up doing? Actually, it's not even modeling anymore. What they do now is what psychologists call replication. They simply do exactly whatever they did for the last 30 years, and they begin to do it again, simply in a different job. Sometimes in the same one, if it's some of the agencies will let you actually come back and take the same job. Only just the color of your badge is the only thing that's different. So they do that. And then they show up at my door someday, saying, "Gosh, we're so unhappy. I'm so unhappy with what I do. I really wish that I could have chosen better." And once we get that job, it sometimes feels too late, and so forth. Anyhow, that advice about I'm very keen on the notion, and do it myself, to constantly recheck who we are, what's the best next step, the next direction to take. By the way, mediation came out when I took the tests just 6 months after I retired. I took a set of tests, and mediation came out for the first time ever. It had never shown up as a career field to look at. And so hence my previous expressions. So that's how I help folks really to start by knowing themselves, no matter where they are in the process. And the earlier that we do it, I think the more satisfied our career will end up being.
Okay, let me take that off on a tangent. Let's say somebody comes to you and says, you know, I kind of like my job, but I don't like my job, and I think this is what I want to do. And if you discover after a while that maybe their supervisors are the ones causing the problem, or vice versa, it's not always a supervisor.
Right.
How do you say, listen, there's nothing wrong with your job, it's where you're doing it. Or
right.
The supervisor, maybe you coach supervisors and say, here, this is going to rub people the wrong way, and if you want to bring the best out in them. Do you work on both sides?
I do. I have. I'm not doing that currently. And one of the primary directives, the prime directive for a coach is to recognize who you are coaching. And therefore, in any communication snafu, there are always two sides to that, as you just indicated. It maybe it's a trait of the supervisors, maybe it's the person, and so forth. I say it's always both. It's always both. That in both cases, that neither one is sufficiently recognizing what is going on, and therefore, and is not taking sufficient or corrective action affirmatively. When I'm coaching someone, though, they're the one I can work with. They're in the room. They're the one whose behavior I can question and coach in terms of changing that behavior. You know the old saying, if you continue to do the same thing, or you continue to approach the same person the same way over and over, but you expect a different outcome each time, that's one of the definitions of crazy. It's also what most of us do. We think that if we just keep trying, that the boss is going to change, because at some point I'll get it, and so forth. So what I'll do is I just did this recently with someone. I know, not only in the coaching process, we do a lot of role play. And so I, as best I understood his description of the boss, I pretended to be the boss and said, try me. And then we tried some different ways of approaching to see if maybe a little different result might appear. So, it was successful in that when that person went back to her boss, and approached again, from a different way. She called me that afternoon, actually, to say, oh, Mike, it's amazing. My boss has changed completely. I said, no, your boss didn't change. You changed. And therefore, your boss is responding now the way you wanted her to.
Okay, on the professional coaching side, let's take that same person, and they're either unhappy or mad at the world, and then switch it over to the life side. What could cause the life side to cause the aggravation on the job, or vice versa? I mean, I'm leading with this one. Should there be a balance in one's life?
Here's an idea.
Yeah, that sounded like a softball. But
sure.
How do you drill down into that and pull that out and say, here's your problem. You're spending too much time or too little time at the job, and you're too little time, and you've got tasks to do, and you can't do them, so you get frustrated. Or you spend too much time and you don't spend enough time away. How do you get the person to change their?
Well, that's something that only they can both decide and change. And so my methodology is to be a mirror, to present to them what I hear them saying, and compare that to our initial work, which was in building the model of what would be a happy, that's important, a happy and fulfilling life. What are the pieces of that, and so forth. And so now we're looking at a particular situation, the job, and perhaps a relationship on the job or some portion of the job. And we match that against the model to see if there's a and if they say to me, you know, that's a disconnect. I don't want to keep doing it that way. That's not something. Now we can look at options. Okay, what are some things that you can do? Can you rewrite your job? Sometimes you can. Sometimes it is possible. Maybe not overnight, but it is possible to approach a boss to say, I would like to do more of this and less of that. And here is a plan for how I might get there. Don't just take the problem, take a recommended solution. And often, especially if it's based on fact, most bosses are not surprised. They are aware, and they're not surprised when they hear, gosh, this part of the job, I'm not very good at it, but I don't really like it either. But all these other things I am good at, can we figure out a way? Because maybe Sally, two rows over, is excellent at this negative stuff and would love to have more of it, and so forth and so forth. But bosses can't do that on their own in most cases. If we don't talk to them, if we don't, or we're not honest and open to say, here are my, here's what I'm experiencing. We make it observable, behaviorally based statements, and then have a recommendation. And maybe that's not what the boss would want to do, but at least we give them somewhere to start with that. Maybe it's even a matter of them saying, can you, this happened to me actually once in a job, can you just do this for 6 more months? Can you put up with this one part of the job? Because the new budget comes in then, and I have a spot for somebody, and I can put that piece into that new job, which is yet to be filled, it's not approved yet, but when it, I know it will be, and if, can you bear with me for that period of time? But you know what? We had it on the table. We both understood, and he was more appreciative every time I did something in that one area that I detested. he was so appreciative that I sort of sucked it up and came through for him every time in that area. But I also felt better because I had light at the end of the tunnel. I thought to myself, I'm not stuck indefinitely, because you know what would have happened? I would have looked for another job. I would try to find one that, and that isn't always the best answer, or it's an answer. Yeah.
Wow. How about the glide path to retirement? And you know, the person likes what they do, but they're tiring of it.
Yes.
But they don't want to not work. Mm-hmm. How do they determine which runway to land on? I mean, do they take this assessment tool and say, okay, this is what you do, but a tangent to that, you might want to look at this. Mm-hmm. Do things like that come out of an assessment tool?
They do. They do. And that's one of the beauties of it, because when we have a critical conversation with our supervisor, we're able to base it on data rather than simply what might sound whimsical. I just kind of don't like it. That's all I can say. You know, no, there's data that says why I don't like it. It is not within my personality trait as I now am, as the person I now am. And by the way, this has often been the case when a person is even extremely good at some area. But they hate it. And the boss doesn't know, because the boss just sees them winning and winning and winning and is thinking, wow, I've got a real winner here in that area. Boy, I'll never let her out of that, you know, that sort of thing. And then one day the person is gone. they transferred to another department or whatever, and the boss is scratching his or her head saying, well, what happened? I thought you loved what you did. No, I was good at it. That's different. That's why I coach people to be as open and honest as possible, but measuring the risks of communication, because there are risks.
How often should one sit down with the folks that work for them, or vice versa, the employee asks, when can we meet, boss? Should this be twice a year, once every 4 years?
Which is what it turns out in a lot of places. And actually, I think the ideal is no less than every 6 months. I used to teach a course in performance appraisal, and one of my mottos in that course was, there are no surprises at performance appraisal time. No surprises. If you have an employee, and I was teaching supervisors, if you have an employee who reads what you wrote and says, yikes, I had no idea you felt this way, you have failed. If that's the case, you missed a major portion of your responsibility. Why? Because they should have known. They should have known on a weekly, daily, incidental basis as it occurred. There should have been a communication, but you save it up for that one time a year and you unload both barrels. And what happens is it's no longer a performance appraisal. It's really a report card. The difference being a report card means fixed in time. This is the grade.
And you've lost a year of performance.
Yes, exactly. Often it can be an entire year. Good point, Bob. Yeah.
I'm getting an education here.
Okay. Is there something you wanted to tell me?
I got too many issues. I'd be on the couch for 4 days, I think, and you'd probably retire. Future care. This is one of the topics said we'd like to talk about. Now is the time to make decision regarding our lives and our and future. Is it, when's it too early to do this, or when's it too late to do this?
First of all, when we are, I would say, in our mid-40s and beyond, it's not too early. It's time to at least put it onto our radar screens, our personal radar screens, a plan for the balance of our lives. And then the older we get, the more precise that plan ought to become, so that I'll give you an example, and I'm advocating by this topic, and in a book that I have coming out later this year, I'm advocating that that people go as far as in their 50s, certainly by their 60s, to sit down and decide precisely beyond a living will. Which has to do with healthcare decisions. And that's important to include, but also where will I live? Under what set of circumstances will I get what kind of living situation? At what point? You'll love this. At what point will I give up, surrender my car keys? Huge issue. And any listener, anyone in my audiences, I see heads nodding in my audiences when I say this phrase. I love it because I know why they're nodding. They're nodding because they're either in the middle of it with their parents, or they have been. And they remember, and as I do with my dad, I remember the day that the family all looked at me and said, why don't you talk to him like that? And I had to excuse yourself, Bob. I had to be the one to talk to him about that. Now, I made some decisions 2 years ago when I thought I was very sick. I was very sick, but I thought it was something much more long-lasting. Turned out not to be. Happy to report. However, I didn't know that at the time. And there was a chance that if it was what the initial thought was, that that I may, in fact, spiral down in very short order and perhaps terminally. That being the case, that would be dead. That being the case, I don't mind language like dead. That's what I would be. My point is, though, that I've lived my life as a fairly practical person. I have advocated that. And it seemed to me that if there was only another 2 years, 3 years, whatever there was remaining, that I didn't want to leave to chance or leave to my son, or brothers and sisters. I have two brothers and two sisters. I didn't want them to have to make decisions for me at any point over anything I could think of. So I sat down with my attorney. I wrote a detailed contract, and that contract included when to take my car keys, as an example. And that one's a good one because there actually are, and you can get them from a number of sources, but there are actual observable behaviors that will indicate that one is probably no longer able to drive, and or it's not safe for them to be driving. And I iterated these. I put them in point by point by point. Like there were eight of them, and any two of which, if you see, or any one that's repeated, you know, like that, that's the trigger. And the trigger that pulls is that one of you to come forward and ask me for my keys. If I push back to you, I told them this when we all signed it. And I said to them, if I push back when you ask for my keys, show me the contract. Remind me that this it was my desire. This was my wish. It is not you imposing your wishes on me. And that's really the bottom line of this whole idea of having a contract, is that I want to live my life my way, the way, and make choices while I'm young enough to think them through and to think about who am I and what is it that makes the most sense to me, and then indicate that and commit people to it. Now, I'll tell you, of course, what my lawyer said. He said, I think this is great symbolism, Mike. I said, oh, you're telling me this is not legally enforceable? He said, what are you going to do, sue him? That's true. He's right. It's in that sense. But as he went on to say, like any contract, it is only as good as the goodwill of the signatories to that contract. Always. Every contract is that way. And he said, so you're basically in good faith, you're asking them to acknowledge. And I took away from them, I included in it my living will. So under what set of circumstances do you pull the plug and so forth? By the way, for me, there are no circumstances. You let it run its full course until I choke. That's, you keep it going. Anyhow, I wrote all those things down because I never want someone that I love to have to make that decision for me. Because as much as people say, and I've heard it, I know Mike. I've known Mike. I know what he would want. And in this circumstance, here's what he would want. Every single time that that occurs, I think they are doing what is in technical terms called lying. They don't know. They really don't know. But they want to make people feel better. They want to make themselves feel better by saying that. But that in fact, unless you had specifically discussed that, and even if you had, it was done in advance. So before it ever arrived, and you don't know what he really wants now. If you have a contract that states, here are the procedures, here's when to do this, here's when to do that, here's when to cut off something and what have you, it's, they can say, well, this is what he wanted. There it is. There it is. And it covered every circumstance we could think of, that to include poverty and things like that. How was all that to be handled? So now I sleep like a baby, knowing that maybe false, but I have a confidence now that my wishes will at least be referred to. At least somebody's going to look it up, because everybody that counts that'll be involved, my older, my younger brother, my older or younger sisters, one of them or my son is going to be, or all of them will be involved. They will not have to have a mediator. There will not be a need for them to discuss their issues, because I've already said what the issue is. Because it's about me, and it's a testimony, frankly, to how I want to be remembered on the way out. I think it's, I mean, I have to think about that, because I realize I'm not going to be here forever. And if I don't state here in my 60s, if I don't state my wishes and put them in concrete, then when am I going to do it? Am I going to wait till I'm sick? Maybe I'd be too sick by then to be able to do that, or to be cogent or cognizant enough to do that. I don't want to wait for that. I wanted to get it done, and I can go back and change it anytime I want. It's my contract, but I am a great advocate of that. I get people out of every one of my workshops who sends me an email. There'll be at least one out of every workshop who will say, can I get a copy of that, please, because I want to do that with my family. And I don't send them the code. It's a little personal, but I do have an outline, and I'm happy to share that with others so they have a place to start if they want to do one.
John and I are kind of car guys, so when do we have to give up our keys, John?
Well, that's was going to be my question to Mike. What criteria do you use in doing this contract about withholding my keys, taking my keys? Mm-hmm. That's kind of puzzling to me, because you don't want to say, oh, at 85, take my keys,
nope,
do you?
Nope, it's not
because
age-based.
I
it's
may be 85, and
good
I'm
point.
Still fine to
good
drive.
Point. No, good
So there must be some other criteria other than chronology.
Yeah, I got them from the website of the National Transportation Safety Board, which does publish, again, in behavioral terms, what can be observed in a person's driving. And I don't remember there was like eight or nine of them, but I don't remember them all now. I do remember having extraordinary incidences, extraordinary meaning for you. I'm, for example, a person who's never had a ticket. Never had a ticket. And every policeman out there that's listening to this will now say, great, where's the studio? Let's get him. But I'm that sort of person.
If I get right two down the street.
I know they are. If I start getting two or three in a row, for things, and again, it's listed what kinds of things, that you would get a ticket for, that's one clue. Mm-hmm. Another would be accidents and, you know, dings. They recommend, in fact, that as our parents get older, we, if they're still driving, we, every time we visit them, we ought to just take a little walk around their car and see if there are new dings and new dents and so forth, and then ask them where that came from. And the worst thing is if they don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. unless, of course, it was done in a parking lot or something, which, of course, would always be my excuse. But that's the point, is that these are observable things. Not just losing the keys, but regularly losing the keys. A memory as to how to get to common places. Not uncommon places like here, but common places. If for example, we have to ask directions every time we go to our sons or daughters' homes, and they've lived in the same house for 20 years, and yet we call and say, "Now, how do you get there again?" Once is one thing. Several times, and you may want to question whether you should be on the road. Anyhow, somebody should, and I'm saying we, all of us, should be the decider and the cautionary, the decision maker about what the things are and how to approach us when the time comes, rather than making somebody else have to go through that.
Question before we bring the show to a close. How does one get in touch with you? This is terrific information and opportunities somebody should take advantage of.
And I am most happy to be contacted. Best way is at my email address. It's very simple. It's my name, but I better spell it because it's got a little strange twist. Okay, you ready? It's Mike Townsend, my name, all run together, MikeTownsh, don't forget the H, END, at AOL.com. And I respond to all of my...
One more time.
Mike Townsend at AOL.com, spelled MikeTownsh, END, at AOL.com.
And, of course, they can listen to you... should you be at one of our seminars.
Yes, indeed.
And I'd like to say we're coming to an agency near you, but that's not accurate. We're coming to your agency.
Good, good.
And you can contact us at nitpinc.com and check out when we're going to be at your agency, because you know we are. John, final comments?
Yeah, we do the financial side, Bob and I, but once you've got the finances in place, I can retire, you're only half there. You need to do the non-financial side. Listen to Mike, somebody like Mike or Mike himself.
Yeah, give it to Mike. All righty. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, John. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.